You're listening to a download from theoutdoorstation.co.uk. Number 4, 3, 1.
Hello and welcome back to The Outdoor Station and the final extended interview of the two-part chat with Alex Kashafi, following his recent return from his epic 6,000-kilometre north to south Europe run. If you haven't listened to part one, do give it a go, as it sets the scene nicely for the range of topics we discuss here, which include the dangers of walking or running on the road and the daily near-death experiences he faced, which forced him to change route. The contrast he found when meeting people for the first time, from open generosity to downright hostility. How Alex dealt with the black dog, the waves of doubt and depression which swept over him more than once. And finally, do ultra runners wear pants? Is this more information than we need to know? So before we get into the interview, I just want to say there may not be a podcast next week as my daughter is getting married. However, I'll be back the following week as normal, all being well. Okay, so if you've looked at the Outdoor Station website and seen Alex's video and some of the pictures from his blog, you will, like me, have noticed the sudden appearance somewhere along the route of a pram. Now, I wondered, was this planned or some cheeky little recycling opportunity he picked up en route?
It appeared last night in Sweden. One friend had it in his garage. He was going to get rid of it. It was pretty much rubbish as far as he was concerned. Another friend has a company called Beerbot, so he could post it cheaper. So it went from one friend to the other. He had problems getting the box. It's a whole other story about the pram arriving. It arrived, and I basically chucked all my stuff in. And I just basically wanted to see what it was like. Long-distance runners, the ones that do continents, generally have a push buggy if they don't have a support team. You know, they're either pulling it or they're pushing something. So I thought, I'll try it. It worked, actually. On cycle paths and paths near, like, the Rhone or the Rhine, worked great. As soon as I went off-road, which I did quite a bit, it wasn't so good. Pushing it through a German forest along a really muddy trail, up some quite hefty hills, and then down a really steep sort of winding, had loads and loads of turnbacks on itself until it dropped down. It was fun, but at the same time, I was really aware that it was really kind of dangerous in terms of my joints and stuff. I could get injured dead easy, and the wheels would grow the further you push the pram because of the mud sticking to them. So it just made it more and more difficult to push. But by the time I reached France, I decided I'm going to keep pushing it. The most I'll push it to is the border of Spain. But while I'm doing it, and sort of from Denmark down, I'm going to use it to really hone what kit I do need and what kit I don't need. So I started with a pack that was 9.5 kilos. It went up to about 14 when I was running through Sweden, based on the amount of food I needed to add to it. And then by the time I reached Spain, it was 4.5 kilos, including water.
Wow.
Which I was amazed. I put it on the scale at the airport and went, oh my God, that's amazing. Like, that's pretty much everything plus a 600ml bottle full of water.
I know women with bigger handbags than that.
Yeah, I think I might have been one of the men with bigger handbags than that. But it basically became a way to hone. It meant I could carry more food. It meant that if I stopped in a McDonald's or somewhere in a train station, armed police would turn up thinking I was up to no good and block me in and question me, which was quite scary. But it kind of, I don't know, my pace was getting faster anyway. A lot of people said once you hit sort of mid to southern Sweden, suddenly you seem to be moving really quickly. And, you know, Denmark was finished, and then next thing you're in Germany, but then suddenly you're in France. And I just kind of made my way down through all the countries, followed the Rhine Valley.
Well, hang on a second. We said we were going to take this up to Christmas. So where did you spend Christmas?
Oh, I'm getting there.
Oh, you haven't got there yet? Right, okay.
No, I haven't got there yet. I followed the Rhine and then cut across a place called Bad... I don't know how to pronounce it. Bad Krotzingen, I think it's called, and headed to a place called Mulhouse and then took a really hilly route in permanent frozen fog. I think I spent possibly an entire month where it was just permanently foggy, or with two or three days where it wasn't foggy, which was a bizarre experience. But I eventually got to within about 30, I think it was about 30 something K before I hit the outskirts of Lyon. And I spent Christmas with a guy called Guillaume, who has he's made me a video as well, which is really kind of him, and he's taken all my footage to use it to make a bit of a film. He came along to do some filming. He brought some food. We had Christmas in a disused shelter type shed thing next to someone's house, just with a makeshift table, which was just a log, a couple of chairs, some pate, some ham, some olives, some bread, and a bottle of Saint Amour wine, because I'd just gone through Saint Amour, which was weird.
So, leading up to that point, then, just talking about that stage, what sort of percentage would you say was off road, was sort of cycle tracks or walking routes, and which was sort of plain cross country, or roads rather, roads? So it's off road, cycle tracks, and roads.
For the Rhine and Germany, there was quite a lot of cycle tracks. It was almost entirely cycle tracks. I'd say probably 25% off-road, what we'd call trails here. About 80, no, it can't be 80, about 70-ish percent was cycle paths, or like the service roads you get on some European motorways. And the rest was road. The road sections were frightening, and they really, really sort of, they ground you down because of the constant noise of traffic and the fact that you're constantly aware that this car's coming at you and you need to kind of watch out what you're doing. Some days, I could run 10K in just over an hour. Other days, it took me just over an hour just to go 3K, because I was constantly pulling aside, waiting for the car to go past so I could make a little bit of progress before the next car came along.
I think one of the most obvious things that your blog does indicate is just how dangerous it is from a point of view that the drivers spent more time looking at their phones than looking at the road.
Yep.
Yeah, frightening.
Or they'd look at me in utter bewilderment, you know, like, oh my god, what's this guy doing, even if I was on a cycle path, and especially in France, and they wouldn't be looking where they're going. I was running in a cycle lane on a minor road, and a woman saw me, stared at me while pulling across into the other lane where there's a car, and I was just running towards, going, oh my god, I'm gonna die because you're trying to be nice, and you're just, what you're doing, you know, look in your wing mirror at least before you pull over. And I pulled right over off the cycle track, sort of half on a little muddy section. And it was frightening. I ended up, once I hit Lyon, I ended up following the cycle track the entire way. And it added 150K onto my route because I didn't want to go on the roads. You know, I'd had quite enough of being petrified by people's driving skills.
Well, you mention it quite often on your blog, so it must have been, you know, must happen on a regular basis.
Yeah, it did. It was sort of a hourly occurrence where something would happen and you'd go, I can't believe they just did that. Quite a lot of people would move over and they'd do it safely, and you'd sort of be, you know, my routine for the run was run, merci or danke, Dankeschön or Gracias as I ran along, even though they can't hear me, you know, waving at them, nodding and stuff like that. But occasionally someone would go past either really, really close or do something stupid. And I'd just more to amuse myself. yeah. Thanks very much. Not lots of comments, which are probably a little bit harsher than that, were being fired off at these drivers. Once or twice, it was actually me being on the wrong road. I think actually once I was on the wrong road.
I think in one of your days, you mentioned you actually got clipped, just slightly clipped by one of the vehicles.
Oh, that was in Spain. It was a massive lorry. Just driving towards me, and my habit was to look at the drivers because, you know, they'd acknowledge you there, they'd shift over, they'd slow down. If they can't shift over or slow down, I know I'd have to move over. This guy had no reason not to shift over or slow down. The road was empty on both sides, and he was looking at his phone. He swerved towards the edge of the road, which, if he hadn't have fixed it, change directions, he would be going down into the valley in Spain on one of the Sierras, and basically I don't think he would have survived. It was quite a big drop, so I ended up diving out of the way, but only just in time. And he did catch the straps on my pack. I felt them get whacked, and they slapped me back. But when I looked at my shoulder, and I don't think I actually wrote this down, but when I looked at my right hand shoulder, I had dust marks where I think it must have brushed past me, because I've been on a road for that entire day. I hadn't gone off road. I hadn't brushed past anything. There was nothing dusty to have created a mark on my jacket, and that was really kind of frightening. But at the same time, it made me really angry, which I'm thankful to the driver that came after, who really moved right across the road, because it kind of snapped me out of the whole just being angry and scared of what's going on and slowing my pace, because I was actually moving quite well at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's one of those moments.
yeah. Well, I mean, in parallel to that, we've had one of our friends here in Malvern was mm-hmm. out running early in the morning, and a lorry did exactly the same thing, except it came from behind her. She was on the pavement and he was looking at his phone, and the wing mirror caught the back of her head. And she had to have brain surgery as a result. But it was a phone issue again.
It is. It's scary how many people are on their phones while driving. It was frightening. You could see them. They've got them on the laps. So you'd have people drive past staring at the laps. Some would have them in their hands. Others would have them on the dashboard. So that they'd kind of be fiddling around with them, but looking at the phone and not the road. It's quite scary, really.
Well, you survived. That's good. You survived. You got past it. But it is something to be aware of. Now, so Christmas was spent in a unused, disused building with some nice pâté, as it should be in France. So did you stop and relax there at any time, or did you just say merci beaucoup and on the way?
No, I woke up the next day and carried on. I didn't really have very many rest days that I said this is a rest day. 17 days I had to stop. 14 were for the tent, 3 waiting for the emergency bivy bag to arrive. And I think after that, I probably had maximum around 10, maybe 11 days of I just need to stop for a bit, or I had to stop to, for example, when I reached Lyon, I borrowed Sophie's inflatable bed. She actually left it at Flensburg in a hotel, so I picked it up. That had a puncture, which meant I couldn't really sleep anywhere without getting cold, because I was in direct contact with the ground at some point. So I had to fix the puncture or work out how to fix the puncture, because I didn't actually have any patches. And I didn't really know how to find the hole, because it was really kind of a tiny hole. I needed to sew some things up. I needed to buy new leggings. So I took 2 or 3 days there. But that was in the gap between Christmas and New Year. And then came to the 30th of Jan, I went off again. The next day off I had was just before I reached Spain in Perpignan. But it wasn't really a day off because I still ran 20K. I just got there really early and got myself into a really, really cheap hotel.
Talking about cheap and money, what sort of budget had you allocated for yourself? Because presumably you had sort of funded all this from selling all your gear and stuff in the UK.
A little bit from saving up and selling stuff. I had about $3,000 for... Basically, I had $3,000 to cover my my bills, which there was enough there to cover 6 months. In fact, there was enough there to cover 7 months. Having to replace equipment in the tent, mainly in Nabisco, and the fact that I had no way of buying any food other than using my bank card, I ended up with quite a lot of that money just being wiped out completely by charges from the bank. And the fact that I had to pay for a room to stay in because I didn't have a tent that functioned by that point. After that, it just purely became crowdfunding, which is part of the adventure that I really don't like, is the fact that other people had to give me money and there was nothing I could give them in return. What I eventually did was put a link on my blog, which is hidden under another page, and it just basically said something along the lines of, I'm going to carry on anyway. Thanks to those people who have effectively bought me a coffee for £2. If you'd like to buy me a coffee. And then there's just a quote underneath that said, I'd like to buy you a coffee for £2. You click on the people were buying me coffees. So I funded this through the kindness of other people, one coffee at a time.
And that must have made you feel quite humble, really.
Ridiculously. I think my last blog post was a thanks, and it's just, how do you thank so many people that got involved with it? Because if it wasn't for their involvement, admittedly, I would have carried on. I did actually say, I'm going to carry on regardless. I'm going to make my money last as long as I can and then just see what happens. Because I've got this far. It would be stupid but it would be a massive waste of the planning I'd put in, the training I'd done, the sacrifices I've made, the fact that I quit my job, the fact that I was doing it to kind of inspire the students that I taught, just to take on challenges that as soon as it got really difficult in terms of money or anything else, that I'm stopping and saying, okay, it's now too difficult. Sorry, I'm going home. You kind of feel, what's the word? Accountable for it at a really high level. But yeah, definitely. I'm still trying to work out how on earth I could possibly thank all these people in a meaningful way, as opposed to just saying, you know, thanks.
Well, I think you touch on that in some of your pages in your blog, which I sort of made a few notes of here. And basically, where is it now? Yeah, this is what you say. We've created a smoke machine, which hides us away, scared, away from the humanity of others.
Yeah.
You were getting,
did I write that? That's
yeah, you're getting very creative in your old age. But that particular day, I think that was in Germany, and certainly the writing, as I say, I read your blog and I read it backwards, as I mentioned to you at the beginning, and I found it really interesting to read the story backwards, because the lead in to, as you get to, you started off with the lead in, thinking, well, how did you get there? And and the mental state that you were in when you wrote that piece was obviously an outcome of the previous day. And it made it quite an interesting read to read the whole thing backwards, the journey backwards.
I think that was the day where the German guy tried to give me money, but refused to believe that Germany had kind people. And I did actually say to him, well, you've just tried to give me money. How can you stand there and say, you know, Germany's full of horrible people, no German will ever help anyone else, blah, blah, blah. I'm just like, what? One, you're German. Two, you're trying to help me. Pointless, you know, I didn't even ask for help. I was standing there, because coins are heavy, I was standing there seeing whether I could buy or how much food I could buy So I was carrying food instead of coins. And as I was counting it, he just got €2 out and said, "Do you need €2 in German?" And just, I kind of looked at him, gone out, like, why, you know, what possessed you to do that at this particular point in time? And he just said, "You're counting your money, you might need it." So, okay.
There's definitely the feeling, though, you had a sort of an epiphany that day. You sort of said that, you know, you realised there was a smoke screen that we all put around ourselves, which is all about fear and locking away the outside and everybody else and keeping ourselves fairly solitary, which is, of course, social media and everything else is all exaggerating and helping. And there you were experiencing fantastic humanity through these four or five countries.
Yeah, it's... It was that. I even had a woman drive past me as I was pushing the pram up a hill in France. She drove past me, went to a shop, and then drove back an hour later to find me with a shopping bag with things that she thought I'd need to be comfortable and to like have a bit of a treat in there as well to make me happier. And I was, you know, I didn't really feel like I needed them, but for someone to do that for a complete random stranger, as opposed to do what some other people did, which was they saw me coming on the street, they crossed over to the opposite side of the road, or they'd avoid me when I was in the shop. That, you know, they'd go round the long way to get to the other side of where I was stood, or feigning vomiting because they thought, you know, there's a tramp just walked in, he must stink. And this was feigning vomiting from a good distance away, so there's no way they smelt me. Or laughing because of the fact that I had sandals on and my clothes were dirty, things like that. But then having this complete contrast in that, it's very weird, it's very strange. It kind of made me stop going on social media because I think that's where most of it is. Mm. You know, there's news story after news story, which is, it's some negative aspect of humanity as opposed to the positives. And I sort of thought about the news stories. Most news stories, there's very rarely many positive things in there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And I was thinking about it like, well, this person here has done something really quite amazing. Why isn't it on the news? You know, that person there has done that. Why isn't that person, you know, having a little mention, if nothing else, just, oh, Dave did this, it was really nice of him. Why isn't that on there so often, you know? What's going on?
Celebrating the wrong heroes for the wrong reasons.
It's worrying about things that haven't actually happened yet. And that's really what it boils down to. I did the same. I mean, I've gone past being embarrassed about it because it's way in the past, but I took on quite a lot of debts, and the way I was living meant that I would develop an amount of debt, sold a house, lost lots of money on it. So I basically spent a real long time feeding that habit of living beyond my means and developing this debt because I thought it's what I needed, if that makes sense.
Mm.
And I was scared of doing anything outside of that mentality because I had to service this debt.
Which you felt obliged to have.
Which, well, it just seemed normal to have. It's quite normal to have, you know. And to have a partner who needs a bit of help with X, Y, Z and needs support, and then say, okay, so I can support them because I have access to these funds, so I'll do this, and there you go, there's a bit more debt, but there's that, oh, she's got a debt, okay, I'll take it on, it becomes one big debt, it's easy to manage, and suddenly you go, oh, actually, we're no longer together, the debt's all in my name, I said I would take over that debt, but I'm going to keep that debt, it seems like the thing I should be doing. And after that, it was, well, I can't go travelling here because I need to be doing X, Y, Z to service this. I can't do this because, which is part of the reason I ended up starting running was because I'd end up in a place where there's nothing else I could do. I'm totally out of control of everything. The idealistic picture of partner, house, really nice place to live, that had all kind of broken apart. was living in Buxton in a small flat. Almost all of my money was going out on bills and things you have to pay for, like council tax, etc. And I had around £80 to last me an entire month for food and for the electricity to keep myself warm or to cook. And that went on for ages before I started to sort of go, actually, you shouldn't, this isn't quite right. You need to do this instead. And I think that only came from being out and running and sort of becoming more aware, self-aware, more confident in myself, that sort of thing. So digging yourself out of a hole that you've just chucked yourself in, because there's something there that you can actually control to start with. But yeah, now I've ran Europe, which is bizarre.
You're listening to The Outdoor Station. Sharing the stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary things.
So, talking about the mental state of things, you know, what about the, tell us about the absolute worst times, the black dog, the paranoia, the depression, and the ways that you handled it, when you recognised that it was coming over you during this experience, and you've got to keep going forward, but you've also got to get your mental state in check. What sort of habits did you get into?
Well, in Norway, when I basically fell in one river one day, which I survived with no injury, but it was more of a section of real deep peat that had washed away to make a river. So if I'd have gone in, I don't think I'd have survived. Then the next day, I ended up falling in another river because I avoided the mistake I made the previous day, only to make a new mistake, and I hurt my leg. And 3 days later, I had... can't remember the distance, but it was about 4 or 5 days in front of me. I had 4 or 5 days behind me. There's absolutely nothing anywhere. I know I'm going to run on food out of food and really low on food because I can't make the progress I need to do. And I, at that point, that, I think that was the very lowest in terms of being lonely because I was injured and I needed things and I couldn't get the things I needed. Even like just a friend going, you'll be okay. How about you try doing this? Because I didn't have access to anybody. I did have quite an interesting moment having a temper tantrum at one of the trail markings and smashing the walking stick I was using that I picked up, like absolutely obliterating this one piece of stick and then looking at the pieces and going, well, that was clever. What are you going to walk with now? Night talking out loud. I had a bit of a rant about feeling lonely and whatnot to the camera I was carrying because I thought it'd be interesting to watch it back, only to start repeating the rant the next day. Got like 2 or 3 sentences in and just, what the hell are you repeating this rant for? It's completely pointless. Just shut the hell up and keep walking, because you're gonna press that button and finish this, or you're not, and you're going to carry on, or you're going to die. It's one of those three options. Which one are you picking? Luckily, I met some people, so it kind of improved 2 or 3 days later. And then it was a case of, well, why the hell did I pick to do this? Am I doing it for the charities and the reason I said I was doing it for, which was to inspire the students and young people to just get out a bit more and do stuff that scares them? Or is it an egotistical thing? I worked out that it was actually a genuine, I want to do it for this. I don't really care about that side of the ego side of things. It makes no difference to me here. Nobody can see me. No one, I can't contact anyone. I can't see any praise from it. I'm not gaining anything. And then later it was, but how the hell is what you're doing going to inspire anyone? Because day in, day out, you're pushing really hard. You're making mistake after mistake after mistake because you're pushing so hard and you're not really thinking things through. How's that inspiring anyone? So what do I need to do? Oh, okay. I need to stop making that same mistake of pushing hard every day. And that was the real, like, the point that just went, oh, okay. Suddenly it's become easier. I had about 50k left to get to the nearest shop. It was around midday. The sun was going to set in 4 hours, 4 or 5 hours. I found a, they're called restplats in Sweden, where they've got little grill that you can have a fire on and cook food if you've got any. There's a wind shelter so you can sit out of the rain. It wasn't really raining. I didn't really need to stop. In fact, I should have carried on. I sat down. I had one one sausage left that I grilled, hung up all my equipment so it would dry. And I think I spent 2 or 3 hours there just sat, doing nothing, just, you know, writing down the thought process I'd just gone through and the moment of, you know what, not going to bother. But then the next, running that extra 50K was really easy. It suddenly became easier to cover the distance because I didn't care about covering the distance. And I kind of came back to that later where I just basically stopped. I ignored the distance I had to run. I just ran and enjoyed what I was doing. If I didn't get there, it didn't really matter because I knew I could make up the distance the next day. I think a friend of mine said, play the long game earlier on. I kind of finally understood what he meant by play the long game. And after that, it was, as I said, it was low days that pulled you out of that mentality. I got blisters just at the base of both my big toes, only tiny little ones, but they hurt. And it was purely because it rained for 3 days and I didn't sort out my feet while I was running with someone, which I should have done. That the next day was really difficult because I just kept thinking, how far have I got left before I can stop? I ended up sat in a bus stop, just got my head down, said, you're not moving till this mentality's gone, till you've got over it. And then got up, went, it was easy again suddenly. Pulling the pram to the side of the road, sitting in it and going, I'm not moving till I want to. I'm just going to sit here. It doesn't really matter. Who cares? You've got ages to make up that distance that's ahead of you. So it was interesting. And it made me think about kids at school starting in year 7. And we're going on about, you know, you've got to do this because of your GCSE exams. And they get to year 10 where they're starting the GCSE years. And we say, oh, you've got 2 years and it's your exam years. And it's really important. I couldn't understand or grasp the fact that I've got so far to go. And if I looked at a map, even 50K on that bigger scale is not all. I think I likened it to having a pin in your hand and scratching at a wall that you're told to take down because it's in your way. And each day you're scratching a tiny, tiny little mark, which you can barely see. But then suddenly you look at it and you go, oh, the wall's gone. How did the wall go? How did I get here? And it was the whole sort of trying to acknowledge tiny steps along the way and not really thinking about how far you've got to go, just going and then stopping and going, oh, I just went that far. Which suddenly was like, well, you know, I've been teaching 7 years. I've tried to explain this to kids, but I've never really understood it myself. So how the hell was I expecting them to understand what I'm trying to tell them? It was, in terms of mentality, there was so much. I think there's bits that I've completely forgotten because what ends up happening is you go through a day, you ditch that day very quickly. It's still in your head, but you kind of push it aside and you move on to the next day. It's a word that I really like. It becomes like a palimpsest, which is just a piece of paper where someone's written something, but there's lots of other bits of writing all over the top. So it's kind of loads of layers of information, all squashed flat, so you can see them all at the same time. Mm. And I think until I sit down and start looking at all the journals I kept, reading my blog posts, which go along with the journals, I've got my photographs to go with them, the video footage. Until I start really picking through those bits, it's really difficult to focus on one thing. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you've got all the different aspects that each note will remind you of, I'm sure.
And everything feeds into everything else.
Yeah,
it isn't just one thing. It's lots of things that led from one to the other, to the other, to the other. So it's like a gradual change. But then you suddenly notice the gradual change, as opposed to suddenly, you know, there's a eureka moment. I don't think there is generally a eureka moment as such. It's you suddenly realize what's been going on and go, oh, okay, that's fine. I'll carry on like this now.
Mm. I think it's definitely a case of, as you probably are doing anyway, is writing your memoirs now while it's still relatively fresh before real life gets in the way again and starts to sort of tone it down.
Yeah, real life is not really going to get in the way. I'm only going back to 3 days of teaching because I think with 4 days I can work on writing everything down, picking through it, sorting out the photos, getting out, speaking to in schools or at adventure festivals, etc., doing that sort of thing. But I consciously made the decision along the way that when I get back, I'm not going to full-time teaching. I'll earn what I need to continue servicing what I need to service and have enough money, just enough money, to put a little bit aside and to basically eat to live.
Mm. Work to live and not live to work.
Yeah, yeah, basically. Live within your means as opposed to just keep pushing your means further outwards. So your work then has to go further outwards to compensate for what you're wanting to buy or where you're wanting to go, that sort of thing.
So talking about the support that you've had, it's all on your blog, which we will be putting links to, and people can have a look at that, and also the charity details as well. But I think one of the unwritten sponsors of your trip, that's certainly a name that seems to appear on a regular basis, which I'm sure you can give us a much more European view on now, is McDonald's.
Yes. The mecca of warmth. Yeah, I did eat at McDonald's quite a lot. Well, I didn't necessarily eat at McDonald's quite a lot. I did spend a lot of time in McDonald's, charging my mobile phone, using toilets, basically having somewhere where I can access water that comes from a tap, as opposed to a plastic bottle or a stream. There was a few occasions where I went in, grabbed empty cups, put them on my table as though I bought the drink and just stayed in there for 3 or 4 hours, just making sure all my stuff's either dry or whatnot. And it makes bizarrely good running fuel. I ate one Big Mac, 5 cheeseburgers, a portion of chips, 1 coffee, a large Coke, and then ran 40K. The fastest I've run 40K, I'd run 40K for a long time in Sweden. And then ate another cheeseburger along the way. And I couldn't believe I had that much food in me and it was actually getting processed. It's a little bit embarrassing eating McDonald's, really.
Well, it's hardly eating with the locals, I guess. But from a practical point of view, they open early enough and it's consistent, isn't it?
Yeah, they're open on a Sunday. That's one thing. I was flicking through one of my journals. That's one thing that I kept forgetting, because you don't concentrate on days. It's not like, oh, it's Monday today, tomorrow will be Tuesday. You just get on day, one after the other. And as soon as I hit France, I'd be in places where the shops are shut on a Sunday. So the only place I could eat was a McDonald's. So I basically either ran from shop to shop during the week. As soon as I realised it was a Sunday, I'd have to redirect to the nearest McDonald's, which was usually sort of, I think the maximum distance I had to run to McDonald's was about 30K, which is what, 18 miles. It was quite amusing. I did spend a long time in some of them, like 3 or 4 hours of just sat. But at the same time, I think I needed it.
And what about the armed police that turned up one day?
Oh, those? Pretty sure it was in Bonn. I was sat eating. I'd only really just arrived. Sat eating. Moved to where there was a plug so I could charge my portable battery and my phone. Just writing notes in my little journal. And I kind of looked up and saw 3 police marching towards the door. They're wearing full-on Kevlar jackets. They all have sidearms anyway, just a little handgun. 2 of these guys were carrying submachine guns, and they walked in, looked at my pram, looked straight at me, and then blocked me into the little table section I was sat at. My heart was absolutely pounding when they did that. I was petrified. But the amusing thing is, the guy barked something at me in German, and I just looked at him and went, do you speak English? And I watched him deflate slightly as he realized that his grand entrance was completely shut down because I had no idea what he was saying. They asked for my passport. As I walked towards my pram, I noticed the guy sort of see my footwear, and he actually said, and I understand enough German to know that he basically said, look at his feet, in sort of like a shock horror sort of thing. Handed over my passport. One goes off to check my passport. The other one still stood there with his finger over the trigger, while the third guy kind of just, you know, asked me a few questions like, where are you from? Where did you, where have you come from to get to here? Where are you going? Oh, Tarifa. Oh, it's lovely in Tarifa. You can look across and see Gibraltar. It's beautiful and really warm, warmer than here. It's really cold here. By that time, the guy came back, gave him a passport. I said, yeah, it's all okay. It's fine. And they both basically said, oh, yeah, it's really cold in Germany. And I looked at them, having told them what I'm doing. I went, it's not cold in Germany. And they just, yeah, whatever, and walked off. yeah, I was really frightened. I can't believe how like fast my heart was going. I could actually feel it sort of batting around inside my chest.
Brilliant. Okay, well, we've got to be coming to an end. I've taken enough of your time, and it's been fascinating to talk to you. I know you've got a list of equipment, which we'll obviously link to, but just to give people an idea what that 4K or 4.5K consisted of on your rucksack when you actually came back, what did you actually minimise everything down to?
I had a sort of a thermal running top. It was pretty much entirely Alpkit gear. I had a thermal running top, which they sent me in Sweden, and it lasted the entire journey, being worn every single day. I had their Gravitas waterproof jacket and their, I think they're called Parallax waterproof trousers. I had a Pipe Dream 400 down sleeping bag, the Sol emergency bivy, the really light one, around 130 grams. I didn't have anything to cook with. I realized I'm not using it, and the calorific value of food that you can cook is nowhere near as much as the salami or the cheese that I just ate day after day. What else did I have? I had my sandals. I had a pair of the windproof Lunar sandals, socks, merino top, long sleeve, a interesting knit merino leggings, which were really warm but really, really light. They were more like pajama leggings than they were running leggings. The shorts and t-shirts that I was wearing, stuff to charge my phone with, so the cables for phone. Cable and batteries for camera, a couple of SD cards, a little GoPro, bottle of water.
And what do you do for things like underwear and, you know?
No underwear. I didn't wear underwear for 6 months. 6 months, 10 days of running.
I'll just leave people to think on, to ponder on that thought.
But there is a question in terms of running, you know, long distances or just running in general. Do you wear pants or do you go no pants? I've asked it before to some runners, and the responses are quite amusing, but it's like a split vote. And it depends on what you're doing, how far you're going, what the conditions are like. But it was generally just the leggings. So it was bare bones of what you actually need. So washing my kit, I had to make sure I was somewhere where I could basically sit with no clothes on at all while my clothes dried. And in one occasion, the aircon broke, the water was freezing, so I couldn't really wash properly. I ended up putting on damp clothes the next day and running over the Sierra Baza in Spain just to dry my clothes, as well as get to where I'm supposed to be going. I can't believe I'm laughing at stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, I can just imagine you've got it laid out next to you in the van there, and you're actually looking at it going, well, that's it. That's all I've got.
I gave quite a lot of it back to Alpkit so they could see, hey, how often do you get kit tested for that longer period of time and day in, day out I said, you know, do you want them back for research purposes? Same with the Nordisk tent. I think I probably know more about the Nordisk tent than most people who own or even design the Nordisk tent in terms of how it functions in different conditions, because I've had all the different conditions as I've ran south. 120 days nearly that tent was pitched. But you can kind of see what happens to it over time, as opposed to, you know, it's locked away, comes out for a little while and goes away. It's 7-10 years old. By that time, there's a new model.
So you've what, back a couple of days now. What would you reflect on that, as a result of all this, that happiness represents to you now?
I've written a blog about that. Have you seen it?
No.
Yeah, just have a look. I think it's pinned up in on the inside of the toilet cubicles at Alpkit. Because I visited there and they said, oh, yeah, we printed one of your articles and stuck it in the toilet. Wow, that's an accolade. It's lots of things. It's just coming out of the warm, out of the cold. It's knowing you have food or water. It's getting a random smile from a stranger who's walking past you or driving past you. It's having someone appear and basically just say hello as you're going past them. It's very little, really. I mean, I think happiness is just being able to be, I guess. It's a really difficult question to answer coherently. I'd say read the blog post, because that has lots of things. I mean, I think one of them was happiness is having a warm cup of coffee in the morning. It's the smell of burning birchwood because it reminds you of something else, or the taste of cucumber because you haven't eaten it for so long that you devour the thing like it's some kind of miraculous cake. It's knowing that you've got friends and family close by and you can get to them.
And what has inspired you about your journey?
Inspired me.
What have you come back inspired about? Anything?
Not sure about inspired. It's all a bit unreal at the moment, really. It doesn't feel like you've done anything. I think human kindness definitely has to be on there in terms of I think I'm more open to being kind to people as opposed to doing the judgment thing, which we all do. Or we all do at some point, whether we realize it or not. To the point that to lighten my kit, my stuff went to homeless people as I ran past them. I saw a guy sat on the floor as an example. I had two ground mats, really thin one that was sort of slightly reflective, and then I had just a standard cheap foam mat. I didn't need the reflective one anymore. Ran past, I was running along with it in my hand, saw a homeless guy just sat on the floor itself, just handed it to him and carried on running. It didn't even really stop. Just sort of passed it over and, you know, and gone. So I think that aspect is definitely sort of a bit that's inspired. It's inspired me to do more to help people and just be more open to helping people without actually ever even sticking around to get the thanks. It's inspired me to push myself a lot harder, because I know how much I pushed my body in the last few weeks to get to the end, and it almost became a game, and I never quite pushed it to the point where I was thinking, God, I'm going to break if I don't stop. But, you know, if I don't stop right now, or if I don't cut back, I'm going to end up breaking. So I'm inspired to get out and do some harder stuff, which I'm not going to mention yet because I haven't planned any of them. And it's inspired me to get out and get kids, especially people like sixth formers, to take gap years. I don't know why no one encourages students that finish their GCSEs to go and do something small in the UK. something small that has a reasonable safety net. So that person is kind of learning about themselves and learning coping mechanisms that they're going to need as soon as they hit A-levels or college or apprenticeship. Because unfortunately, for some kids, for majority of kids, the stuff isn't there in a classroom, in the classroom environment you're expected to have based on whatever X, Y, Z. That sort of support for that those skills to be developed isn't actually there, and it's really difficult to put them in a classroom. So I think I'm going to be going to trying to get into a lot of schools and saying, look, there's all these things you can do. Look at me as an example. I'm just a teacher, but suddenly I've done this. You know, it's yeah. There's a lot to think about and a lot to get organised, I think.
Well, you know what the final question is. You've had it before, so I'm sure you're prepared for it. But and it's an epic one with regards to this particular journey. But of all the things I could have asked you, what should I have asked you?
What should you have asked me? Oh, there's loads, isn't there? How much food was I eating? Most people tend to ask who were the kindest countries and whatnot, but most countries are they were as kind as each other. Which country was the best country to run in, I think is what you should have asked me.
And what would your answer be?
I'd have to actually say where we're the country we've got right round us, actually. Because I ran on the Saturday after I got back, and it's stunning. It's the landscape we've got here is, I know people go, oh, the Norwegian fjords and X, Y, Z, but we've got stuff almost identical on this little block of land of ours. So I think we're too busy looking at far away. And I think I wrote something for OutKit based on this topic of far away but near to hand. And you can find Norway or Sweden and the wilderness if you go north in England. You can find the amazing sort of rolling farmland and the vineyard sort of landscape that you have in France, in Germany and in Spain. And you can find it near the Peak District and further down south. You can find the really rocky stuff of the Sierra Nevada and the coastline of Spain by going to the English coastline on the west side. I think we're ridiculously lucky, and we're too busy looking elsewhere to realise how lucky we actually are.
Alex isn't the first person I've interviewed who has concluded like this. We are very lucky in the UK in more ways than one. Now, if you've enjoyed these podcasts, please leave a comment on the Outdoor Station website or Alex's blog, or both, of course. I see he's just written a long reflection on his trip, which makes for good reading and more food for thought. My thanks to Alex for taking the time and sharing so openly his experiences on the trip. Right, I've now got a wedding speech to write and to see if I can still squeeze into my suit as I set my daughter off on an epic adventure of her own. It seems like only yesterday she was a babe in arms, and it's another harsh reminder that time waits for no man. Bye for now.
Thank you for downloading this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorstation.co.uk.